Welcome to Cybersecurity Where You Are, the Center for Internet Security's podcast. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO at CIS.
And I'm Tony Sager, Senior Vice President and Chief Evangelist at CIS. Cybersecurity affects us all, whether we're online at home, managing a company, supporting clients, or running a state or local government.
So join us on Wednesdays as we discuss trends and threats, explore security best practices, and interview experts in the industry.
Together, we'll clarify these issues, creating confidence in the connected world.
Hello, and welcome to the show, Cybersecurity Where You Are. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO here at the Center for Internet Security, joined by the host with the most, the Hall of Famer, Mr. Tony Sager. How are you, Tony?
Great, Sean. Great to be back with you.
And not only do we have one Hall of Famer today, we have two Hall of Famers. Mr. Steve Lipner, how are you, sir?
I'm well, Sean. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you so much. So joined by two Hall of Famers is the topic is to review the concept of secure by design. Now, one of the elements that we've seen is there's been a number of different topics and initiatives in this space. Most recently, CISR's approach to secure by design. So ultimately, Steve, what I'd like to do is if we could start with maybe a little bit of your background and your amazing career in cybersecurity, and then we'll jump into some of these topics, if that's all right with you.
Sure, that's great, Sean. So in terms of my career, I mean, I could take more time than we've got. Got started, sort of drafted into what we now call cybersecurity when I was a relatively new staff member at the MITRE Corporation, and they were working for the Defense Department trying to achieve what was called then multi-level security, basically managing classified information and computer systems. And I got asked to build and lead a small team to solve that problem for the Air Force back in late 1970. And I said, I don't have the right background. I'm not a computer scientist by education. I don't know that level of deep system programming kind of stuff. Can you find somebody else who's better qualified to do that? And my boss said, well, why don't you see what you can do until we get somebody who can take it over from you? And that was, as I said, late 1970, and I'm still waiting, never quite got out. I worked on multi-level security one way or another, first at MITRE and then at Digital Equipment in the days of the Anderson Report and the NSA Orange Book until the early 90s, ran the firewall business for a few years at Trusted Information Systems, back in Maryland, and wound up joining Microsoft in 1999, first to run security response for them, dealing with publicly discovered product vulnerabilities. And then after a couple of years, was reorganized into responsibilities that included the software security function. And that's how I've spent the last almost 25 years now.
What an amazing run, Steve. Yeah, I remember I was a kid reading some of the papers that were coming out of that time. And the notion was around, technology that we could trust and coming, I'll say, from a logical mathematical basis, right? Could we talk about properties that were good, the good security properties, and how could we say something about them mathematically, right? Can we assert a thing and prove it to be true or not true, et cetera? And so some of the most amazing, smart people I've ever met were working on those things back in those days.
It was an amazing crowd and interesting work. And, bouncing from that, abstract security model world to, the very commercial and user-oriented, and people have to want to be able to use it, be able to use it, was kind of an education for me of its own, because it turned out that a lot of the things that we did back in the 70s and 80s enabled you to build a system that nobody wanted to use. And so building systems that are secure and usable is even more of a challenge. But it's what we've got to do.
Yeah, that watching that shift, if you don't mind showing the historical break here, you know, from the government will sort of figure this out, right? Sponsor the research, pay for it, bring together the great minds in, for example, the National Computer Security Center. And it was a bit of thinking like, if we build it, they'll come, right? We can create the technology. We've got all this brain power. We have the classified applications and the data to be protected. So the motivation was certainly there, but hey, it didn't run PowerPoint. So, you know, and we saw the shift to say, it's the commercial marketplace that drives the requirements and the needs and that pacing, which is not sort of what you think of as the government pacing, right? So the government was willing to invest a lot, but the market, as it, you know, that we hit what we called then the personal computer revolution and the information revolution, the pace picked up so rapidly that, you know, it became, I used to call all the security stuff we dealt with Steve back at NSA, the designed by PC week. You know, the boss would see something in PC week and go, wow, that's really cool. We need that now. I didn't know I needed it last week, but I need it now. And why are you security guys holding me back? And it was like, wait a minute. The world just turned upside down. And so, you know, learning to adapt to that was the transition.
It really did. And the biggest criticism of the work back in those days is probably just that nobody sort of bothered to ask the users. Nobody bothered to ask the chief security officers. We had a couple of scenarios where what we were doing worked or appeared to work, but we really extrapolated from those to say that's what everybody needs. And that was just wrong.
And you know, Sean, that's right in your wheelhouse, right?
Oh, it certainly
you must
is.
Get pestered constantly about, I need this new capability, I won't say AI, and why are you holding me back? So that risk decision, I mean, you're right in the middle of that every day, right?
Oh, absolutely. And Steve, I'd go back and say, we're still not asking those questions of the end user or the chief security officer today. We've not learned, which is unfortunate. But no, you're absolutely right, Tony. I mean, that is where really on the precipice of thinking about the integration of technology and ultimately the way now we see the digitization necessarily of our lives, it becomes even more important. And you look now to third party, right? And even, you know, back when talking about secure by design was, well, it's our design. Now it's everybody's design, and it's a contributive factor to a supply chain, which we're now having to necessarily untangle within the very, very complex landscape. And it's certainly not easier by any means, Tony, in that space.
Hey Steve, so share with us, so you had that amazing shift, right, from the classical, I'll call it computer security days, to the most pragmatic of all, the Microsoft environment. And what were your big concerns or areas that you wanted to take on when you looked at the whole software development lifecycle and how that plays out at the big commercial supplier?
Well, when I joined Microsoft, I think I said, you know, I started out there running the Security Response Center, which was the team that dealt with externally discovered vulnerabilities. And so initially it was just, I don't know whether people, I mean, you do, Tony, Sean probably does, remember Code Red and Nimda, the big internet worms that affected Microsoft software that hit in 2001. You know, the big initial motivation was sort of make the pain stop, make the pain for the customers stop, and make the complaints about Microsoft products stop. And so what we wanted to do initially was, you know, what can we do to reduce it? I mean, I don't think any of us thought we were going to get to perfection, but that level of stuff was just, you know, was just unacceptable. And if it had continued, it would have really been a significant business impact. So what we were trying to do was to say, okay, can we make a significant improvement relatively quickly? And that was what led us, by this time I was responsible for security response and also for software security practices, that led us to do what we called the Windows security push. And in defense terms, you know, that's what the Air Force or the Navy would would call a safety stand down. Okay. I mean, stop doing what you're doing and focus everybody on the issue of security. And we stopped 8,500 people in early 2002 and told all of them, okay, your job for the next couple of months is security. And behind that, we had some discipline and some technical approaches, but it was pretty pulled together quickly and pretty sketchy at that time. But there was enough so that we got people to pay attention to it, and we made sort of a first increment of progress then.
Yeah, I guess, and I was observing all that from the NSA government side, and it felt to me very serious, right? That it was more than a kind of a bumper sticker, we're going to get better, but there was in fact a stand down and a lot of training, a lot of activity, as you said. It was in a hurry also, but you know, I never, just based upon the observations I had, it seemed like, oh my gosh, they're really going to take this and run with it. And we were still sort of figuring this whole network security thing out, right? As you said, the first big worms, these first things that, like, oh my gosh, worldwide impact, boom, like that. And you guys got to see it, you know, reflected back to you, right, as the source.
We got to see it all right. It was driven by the history of vulnerabilities as we understood them. And that's something that, you know, has stood the community in good stead. You know, you try to, you know, Rick Proto theories of security come from theories of insecurity. And then, you know, what are the techniques that you give developers who are not security specialists to enable them to build secure software? You know, and that's a matter of technical approaches and also of motivation. They've got to take it seriously, and you've got to give them things that they can understand well enough to do, and do in a, you know, sort of a finite way.
Well, I think it's interesting in terms of you know, building out such a capacity and capability takes time, as you mentioned. You know, in some cases, it's kind of a virological approach in order to assess representatively, well, what happened? How do we prevent it from happening again? What are the types of mutations that we can see necessarily in terms of both the development? And we see that today, you know, across multiple different implementations, specifically, and we'll mention AI again really quickly, Tony. But seeing now the advancement necessarily in both exploit development, vulnerability detection. And with that, we'll be right back after this quick break. Are you struggling to meet the standard of reasonableness in your cybersecurity efforts?
CIS Secure Suite comes with integrated cybersecurity tools and resources you can use to build a reasonable cyber defense program.
This will help you comply with U.S. state data privacy laws, and it will empower you to demonstrate you've implemented the necessary security measures to avoid liability in the event of a data breach.
Now through November 1st, save up to 20% on a new CIS Secure Suite membership using promo code RCD. 24.
Make your cyber defense reasonable.
Achieve it with CIS Secure Suite.
Visit www.cisecurity.org/CIS-Secure Suite to learn more. Thank you. And let's jump back into the episode. Given your role at Safecode, what's Safecode's perspective on how we prevent such capability with secure by design approaches today?
What we've tried to advocate is for people, it's really two things. It's sort of doing, you know, doing the basic stuff, you know, that everybody ought to do. Like, you know, if you can use a safe programming language rather than one that's vulnerable to memory safety errors. But then it's also be able to do really three things. One of them is do those basics. One of them is be able to do a level of analysis to understand where your design is subject to threats, subject to attacks, and how to mitigate those. And then the third, of course, is continuous improvement. You know, learn from the vulnerabilities. Don't just patch what somebody reported to you, but understand what's going on and figure out how you have to adjust your designs, your practices, your code to keep those things and their friends and relations from occurring. And if you do those things, then over time, you ought to get on a track of continuous improvement. And that's really what we aim to do, is to get development organizations on a track of continuous improvement, and try to make the bad guys' jobs harder and harder.
Exactly right. Building, in some cases, we'll use the mousetrap analogy, Tony, in terms of we'll build that better, making it stronger necessarily. And then ultimately, when we see vulnerabilities identified, again, feeding that, like you mentioned, a kind of a root cause analysis, can we get that back into an approach that we feed through the secure by design necessarily ecosystem of information. And I think it's also very important, and I'd love to get your opinion, Steve, on security awareness from a developer's perspective versus it being that's something that's dealt with outside of necessarily our group. We you know, create the code, ultimately it's assessed and goes into production. We'll deal with the consequences. Are we starting to see on the need necessarily with secure by design, get that in early, get developers aware and understand their responsibility in this whole life cycle?
That's incredibly important. Okay. I mean, I've seen organizations whose approach to the software security or secure by design, you know, was have a security team, you know, and the security team will try to tell the developers what to do. And then after the developers have done whatever they do, the security team will review the code or run the tools on the code, find what they think are all the bugs, and pass them back to the developers to fix. And that sort of takes the ownership from the developers to the security team. And that, you know, that's, you know, other than being slow and not scalable and ineffective, there's nothing wrong with that approach at all. but in fact, I mean, one of the things that we found, even going back to the Windows security push, there was so much embarrassment and so much negative publicity and so much customer complaint that every developer in the company knew that we had a problem. And so we were able to tell them, you know, here are the things that we're going to give you to do. And you can understand, you know, here's this training, here are these principles, here are these specific techniques, here's a book, Michael Howard and David LeBlanc, and here are the things we want you to do. And then we'll send, you know, we'll run the tools, but you'll get the tool output and you'll be responsible for figuring out what's wrong, and you'll understand why you're doing it. And if you can do that and make it reasonably effective and productive so that the people aren't wasting their time, then the developers can do a lot more in making code secure than the security team can.
Yeah, that's right, Steve. And, you know, having been, as you might remember, I was one of those independent after the fact analysts, you know, looking at other people's code for a living. I called it staring at piles of other people's writing, hoping for a breakthrough. And one of the key lessons from there is if you're counting that on that as your primary defense, you're doomed, because the challenge is just overwhelming. And if you haven't, as you said, it's a mix of there's technology, right? There's improved technology that you could use, better tools, better, you know, analytics sort of built into the development. But if you don't have a sort of basic business discipline and process management and all that, you know, this is now we're in a production environment here, right? And so you have to build in this machinery of feedback and things that you talked about there. And you know, that was really sobering because I thought, you know, the idea was, I think if you could just turn a smart human being loose, I guarantee you we would find some flaws. And someone would go, oh my gosh, we didn't think of that. Thank you very much. And they get fixed. And then I realized after a few years, I have no idea whether we're better off than we were before I started than we are now, because, you know, finding a few things makes a few people happy, but you don't get any more confidence than you had ahead of time. And so I think that work you did to codify all that right in the SDL, I think, was really one of the groundbreaking activities in the industry.
Yeah, Michael Howard's phrase for what you used to go through was my eyes glaze over. MEGO, and that's, you know, that's useful, especially for super critical, you know, super small components. But when you're talking about, you know, commercial scale software, the developers have to build it securely, and the security teams. Primary job or a major job of the security team is to enable the developers to do that.
I think another aspect of that, Steve, was that you were around a lot of the risk modeling that came out of the nuclear weapons business and software and all those kinds of things. And I said, you know what? I looked at as many of those as I could stand in the 80s and 90s. And I said, you know, the presence of an active adversary screws up every model. You know, because adversaries are very determined, highly skilled, and they also, they don't attack really specifically the software, they attack the system, right? So at the end of the day, security is a composition problem, right? It's a property that emerges when you put things together. So you might write software, and there are domains where that's possible, that exactly meets its requirements. Right, and you've seen the formal methods things and all that, you know, in a particular bounded narrow way, and now you put it into an ugly, messy real life system, and all bets are off, and it's because it's the composition of things that now allows adversaries to find the cracks and the use cases you didn't test for and all that kind of stuff, and so part of what you had to do, and you knew you couldn't solve the security problem right through software development, but you also know that you had to contribute to this larger understanding of security, right? By creating properties in the software or attributes, artifacts that go with it that allow other people to assess risk later on. So any thoughts on the kind of system problem? Because this came up a lot with us in the Cyber Safety Review Board, and I know in many places you've discussed
it. Yeah, that. I mean the technique, people use the term threat model to refer to a lot of different things, but what we tried to do with threat modeling, at Microsoft and Safecode has subsequently published a couple of documents on threat modeling approaches for large organizations. What you try to do is build start out with a description of the system that you're building or ideally that you're proposing to build, and then think about it in terms of trust boundary. You know, what is it trying to protect? You know, where is outside where somebody might be attacking? And what are the operations or the activities that attacker might do? And how have you mitigated those? And those mitigations might be secure code, or they might be security features, or they might be auditing that enables somebody to go back and detect what kinds of things somebody has been trying to do. And that's a difficult process. It's a talent dependent process. People can be better or worse at it, but we tried to provide a structured way to do that so that we would expand the number of people who could do it, because we knew that it's not just you're trying to build a 1,000-line security kernel and everything else is neutered.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, as we threat model internally and assess respective approaches, the level of abstraction can get into both the fictionalized approaches to threat, as it were, and we can get a little bit too carried away. And in some cases, it's not enough information in order to necessarily create a model that's worth creating in some cases, with necessarily understanding the layers of abstraction that we see outside of one or two or even tertiary level supply chains. Very difficult to get that integrated in a lot of cases, at least, as I've seen and played around with threat models in certain spaces and certain scenarios. But it also, Steve, one question that I'd had is, what do you see the effect of modern software development methodologies, such as Agile, DevOps, DevSecOps? Is this contributing to better secure by design, or is there still some way to go in terms of getting that continuous improvement in play and really understanding and getting security, let's say, baked in to the design, but not necessarily just the design, but those that are designing? What are your thoughts there?
The questions about Agile and eventually about DevOps and so on came up, when I was at Microsoft and we were starting to roll out the SDL to the online services teams, MSN, Hotmail, and so on, and the security person in that team talked to me, and he said, our developers, they're doing changes and releases, every week or every few days or every days or every day or multiple times a day. And they don't have time to do this long, elaborate cycle, like a 3-year Windows release does. And so we talked internally about, that's real. What are we going to do? And eventually, a guy named Brian Sullivan took the process definition that we had created and said, okay, these are the things that you've got to do for the project. And then they last for a while. And these are the things that you've got to do, for every release. And it turned out that most of those every release things could be built into the tool chain. And basically, the developer doing Agile or doing DevOps, he's got to do his compile or her compile, and they've got to get a clean compile and a clean build. And so if you just build a static analysis and the testing for security error, security configuration errors into that build process, into what's now called the CI/CD pipeline, why then you can do secure development and do it in the timeframes that people need for DevOps or Agile or whatever your model is. And maybe that's even better because, the feedback loop is very short. And so people still remember what they were thinking about when they get this error report and they can fix it and go on. Whether it makes things better, I don't know, but it's certainly possible to integrate, security into the CI/CD or DevOps model and do that effectively.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, right? In some sense, you don't want to count on the artwork of having to train every developer to some unknown level, but this idea of building more of it, and would it be perfect? No, but so many of the things that eventually turn up as security issues later are really not rocket science in and of themselves, right? They're fairly, they're the things, mistakes we've been making for decades.
The tools aren't perfect, but we can do a lot with the tools, and that you know, a big focus of the security teams at the Safecode members is to help provide tools that give correct, effective, actionable feedback to the developers so they don't have to spend a lot of their time on false positives.
Right. It's one of the things that we've talked about, Steve, here at the Center for Internet Security, right? Our brand is sort of, you know, you can't solve every problem. So let's try to identify the most important set of things. And we've talked to you and, you know, and your team about, is there something that we can do in this space around software security, quality, et cetera, that's kind of in that similar spirit, not trying to redefine the development process, but to, what are the things that we should try to catch through the development tools or process steps. But on that vein, though, any thoughts about what CISA's Secure by Design activity really means to the industry? So to their credit, they put a lot of emphasis on moving things earlier in the life cycle. Can we build, I'll say, less error-prone, higher quality pieces to work with in these complicated environments that we run today. But so they made this one of their major themes here in the recent past. Any thoughts from the perspective of one of the pioneers in this work?
I think their emphasis on secure by design and their emphasis on getting development organizations, you know, committed to doing things securely and in the right way. I think that's all great stuff. In terms of more specific guidance, CISA has, there's a great resource out of NIST called the Secure Software Development Framework. And that is really, I mean, you know, we published a version of the security development lifecycle for people's reference back in the late 2000s, early 2010s. Safecode has created its fundamental practices for secure development. BSA, the Software Alliance, created their guidelines, and the NIST SSDF is really a composite of the best practices of a lot of the work that's gone before. It's abstract enough so that organizations can adapt it to their own, to their own environments, their development style, you know, languages, whatever they're building, but it's concrete enough so there are things that, and basically you've got to look at all that stuff, or you're not, you know, or you're leaving a gap. And I think that CISA is sort of pushing organizations to think about what's in the SSDF and adapt it. And I think that's all to the good. So that's really, really, really an important thing in terms of what's in the SSDF and how you prioritize that. You know, Michael Howard used to talk about the SDL and said, and his view was, well, people really have to do all of it. And it's probably the same with the SSDF. People have to do all of it. You can start small, but you've got to get there.
Right. And this is one of those many problems in cybersecurity that doesn't age well. You might as well get started. But part of it, and we've tried to do that, again, no plug for us here at CIS, but you know, to provide, we'll call it on-ramps, or how do we get started, right? That has been my observation, that the problem can seem so overwhelming that people get paralyzed and so don't get started. And part of having some framework is also providing a way for those who have low resources or starting with low awareness or training to get going and work that will be foundational, right? You can build upon. It's not throwaway work. It's just, it's the things you need to get going.
Safecode worked with CIS on, I'm not sure which version of the CIS guidance it was, and we actually created a companion paper about secure development practices and getting started to try to enable organizations that were maybe smaller and didn't have software security programs but knew they needed to do something. And tell them, okay, you know, here are some things that you should start thinking about as a way to get into doing secure software. That all predated the Secure by Design initiative, and maybe it would stand a little revisiting, but on balance, I think it was a pretty good start and reasonably actionable for organizations that are trying to pay attention to the security of themselves.
No, thanks for reminding us of that, Steve. That, you know, it was the two critical partners that were Safecode and the Cloud Security Alliance. And the idea was, you know, we have these great nonprofits that are specializing in one particular domain, but we could bring them together around version of 8 of the controls. And it's sort of, you know, our brand again is our focus is about not how to solve the entire problem, but how to get started. What are the foundational steps? What are the most critical things to do? So I think that was a perfect, you know, activity between us. And again, something that we'll figure out how to build upon here in the near future.
Absolutely. That was a great, great project, great partnership with CIS doing that.
Well, unfortunately, that draws to a conclusion our show. I wish we could go on more. Obviously, Steve, we've got a lot more we could talk about in this space. And Tony, and it, really understanding that history and where we are today, I think is so important to remember the lessons of the past so we don't repeat them in the future. We're still trying, I think, Tony, but we'll get there. But again, thank you, Steve, for your thoughts and leadership and expertise in this space. It's absolutely unparalleled, and we really appreciate you being on the show today.
Thanks very much, Sean and Tony. It was great talking with you. I always enjoy seeing Tony, and it's good to meet you, Sean.
Well, Sean, yeah, as I've shared with you, Steve is one of the people I admire most in this industry. However, he might be the worst example of how to retire among all my friends. But the industry continues to benefit from his wisdom and the good things that he's doing. So, Steve, thank you again from me and from the Center for Internet Security.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And thank you to our audience. You get the benefit of all of this experience, this leadership, 2 Hall of Famers in 1 episode. Absolutely fantastic. Now, any questions, comments, concerns, by all means, reach out to podcast@cisecurity.org. Remember to subscribe in all the usual ways for episodes every Wednesday. So to hear more like this, join us. And with that, we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to the podcast today. The thoughts and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are solely theirs and do not necessarily reflect those of CIS.
Tune in on Wednesdays for a new episode. And in the meantime, visit our website at cisecurity.org.
Together, we'll continue our efforts of creating confidence in the connected world.